This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
A professor of international relations at the American Graduate School in Paris. McGiffin is in Portland for an upcoming event discussing that crisis at the Red and Black Cafe, which Joe will announce later. Including our program today, Laurie Bolden, our Old Mole book reviewer, will be discussing a book by Jennifer Egan, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2011 for her book, A Visit from the Goon Squad. Laurie will be discussing an earlier work of Egan's entitled Look at Me. But now here's Bill talking with Stephanie Luce about the Troublemakers Workshop.
Hi, Stephanie Luce. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks so much.
Stephanie Luce, you'll be speaking this Saturday in Portland at the Labor Notes Troublemakers School. Stephanie teaches labor studies, does worker education at the City University of New York. She writes a lot, including the book Fighting for a Living Wage. She's always been an engaged scholar and activist herself, including in living wage campaigns and Occupy New York, among many others, dating back to her college days. Stephanie Luce, there are voices even on the left, even among those who support KBOO, who see unions as doomed, that working class movements are so 19th century, that workplace organizing is a lost cause, and that the time is better devoted to any of a myriad of movements. Stephanie, you've devoted many years, continue commitments to building working class movements, and particularly workplace movements. How do you respond to that critique? What keeps you going in the face? We have to acknowledge of lots of defeats and growing corporate power.
Yeah. Well, I guess I've never felt like I had a choice. The situation has just been so bleak for workers and only getting more so. And, you know, it's still at work where we spend the majority of our waking hours. You know, if we have work or if we don't have a job, it's still the thing that we have to stress out about the majority of our waking hours. So, and it's really where, you know, power and wealth is created. So I just feel like we don't have a choice but to keep fighting for justice in the workplace. And I don't see it as an either or situation. I've never felt that it had to be either or. My motivations to fight around workers' rights have always been integrated with my, you know, feelings about fighting for justice in other arenas, whether it's around gender issues, race and ethnicity issues. I can't see how we could separate those fights.
And in fact, I think we can also point out that even if unions have lost a great deal of power and are under attack, in a very important way, no working class movement, no struggle from below that's transformatory can do without power in the workplace. That in fact, a really active and militant and conscious uprising from below based in the workplace is really, it's certainly not going to, can't prevail on its own. But that has to be an important, it seems to me, element of any kind of transformatory thrust.
Yeah, well, the unions, even though they are, you know, losing power and size, it still represents about 14 million people in the United States and several hundreds of millions of people globally. It is by far the largest working class institutional organization or structures that we have. And that's, again, where one of our major sources of power and resources are. Now, I don't think that any of us need to defend the failings or weaknesses of unions. And I think unions need to be on the forefront of, you know, critiquing their own practice and thinking boldly and differently. But the concept of a union is workers organizing amongst each other in the workplace, and I can't see, you know, any benefit to throwing that idea out. That's got to be the core of how we see running work in the future, which is that workers are engaged in self-management.
Mm-hmm. And right now, even in the absence of any kind of institutions in a workplace that could help workers aggregate, most workplaces are not organized. People talk about work. They talk about the relations of work. They talk about the relations with their boss. They talk about how they're getting the short end of the stick. And they're constant, especially now in the workplace with the crackdown, there's just enormous dissatisfaction that people talk about, even if, in fact, they feel I'm better off with any job than no job at all, and I just keep my head down and keep working. It seems to me it's in organizing, it's in talking to those people, it's helping people articulate their grievances and understand the possibilities of something else. That's like a fundamental kind of social interchanges and understandings that workplace organizing is directed to.
Yes.
If I can make, really, sorry.
And, you know, work also, for good or bad, shapes so much of the rest of our lives. So whether we, where we choose to live or where we set up our families and how we set up our families is often shaped by the kind of work that we do or the kind of work we have access to. So there's really no, you know, like it's just central. And in any kind of model I see as a social justice movement, we want to be talking about how we structure work to integrate the healthy parts of our lives, that work should be there to fulfill us and to sustain us, not to constrain our lives and to limit us in what we can do.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mill Variety Hour, talking to Stephanie Luce, talking about why she's sticking with the unions, although a different kind of union. And I think we can probably, now is a good time to talk about the Troublemakers School, because it's not just union organizing of a kind of conventional kind that the Troublemakers School is talking about. It's really a new unionism and new directions in building unions and building worker power and in struggling for consciousness and not just sort of a bureaucratic organization. Tell us about the Troublemakers School and your role and the kind of workplace organizing that Troublemakers are demonstrating.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, some people use the term social movement unionism. Some people talk about working class movements. But the idea really is to help us all learn the skills that we need in the workplace or building labor community coalitions to kind of strengthen our power as workers and as workers' allies, whether that is a very concrete, like what to do about when the boss treats somebody badly at work and you need to, you know, work with your colleagues, your coworkers, to kind of resist and fight back, to how to build real coalitions between different groups that might not work together before. And, for example, I've worked a lot with living wage campaigns that can bring together, you know, environmentalists and building trades folks who don't always see eye to eye, but they all agree on the need for a living wage. So the Troublemakers Schools are a way to kind of build that organizing from the bottom up, from worker to worker or community member to worker, and to really talk about how do we target power, how do we coalesce and maximize our skills so that we make the most of the activism that we do, and how to see ourselves as really being part of a larger movement. We're focusing in our workplaces, but that's connected to workplaces around the country and around the world.
Mm-hmm. Labor Notes has made has done a lot of work discussing and presenting coalitions of efforts to create coalitions, and often real coalitions between environmentalists and labor organizers and unions and worker organizations. I gather that's going to be discussed some at the Labor Notes at the Troublemakers School this Saturday.
Yeah, so part of the theme is how do we build real coalitions, both around fighting budget cuts and, austerity issues, but then also around a more broad vision of, like, it's not just defensive, how do we make these struggles be about something we want to build and not just something we want to fight? So finding the ways in which we have common ground. For example, when we look at the Chicago Teachers Union, the teachers went on strike there, and they were successful because they really had framed that labor struggle as also a community struggle, because they really understood that teachers' working conditions are students' learning conditions, that you can't separate those two things, that the schools are they're a workplace, but they're also, you know, a learning place. So I think the Troublemaker School is going to be talking a lot more about a lot of examples in which people have built this intersection between different kinds of issues and organizations.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Stephanie Luce, who's going to be speaking this Saturday at the Labor Notes Troublemakers Conference. They're not just troublemakers. They're actually envisioning a quite differently structured society. Stephanie, maybe we can end talking a little bit about the personal satisfactions of workplace organizing and the kinds of solidarity and the people you meet and the great pleasures of working in fights, even if many of them ultimately lose. Let's talk about that. First, the kinds of workplace organization. You talked about self-management at the workplace as an ultimate goal. But even in our movements, it seems to me, and in building a labor movements, it's the democratic character that gives it a lot of its strength and builds commitments in people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that's a challenge because when we build coalitions, we're often doing that between groups. Some might have more power than others. Unions sometimes have, you know, staff and budgets, whereas community groups might not. They might be small. I've worked a lot in, student and teacher or faculty coalitions where certainly the faculty have more power. So it's not that it's always easy, but it is, like you said, it's much more rewarding to try and build these visionary struggles. For example, I'll be talking a bit about how at the University of Massachusetts, as the faculty, we were tired of just fighting cuts and tuition hikes all the time, and we said, let's just get together and demand free higher education because, you know, we have to fight the cuts, but we also want to demand a vision of a university that we think will work much better for students and for faculty and for staff. It's about looking forward to a whole other model that can benefit all of us instead of pitting us against each other.
And one final point. I like the slogan. This is this is not a sprint. It's a marathon. Part of the it seems to me of the way of sort of maintaining commitments and a really a good feeling about the movement is sort of recognizing the long view from the left. That is that it's going to be a long struggle. You might not win every battle, but you can win a lot of them and in fact really build a contending force. Be eloquent on that issue and then we'll close out.
Well, I don't know how eloquent it is, but I've always lived my life feeling like I'm at least going to go down fighting. I'm not doing this without a fight. The attack on us is so extreme and severe that I think we can only do what we can to fight back. But on the positive side, you're right that it is in building these struggles together that we build our relationships, we build our own sense of self-worth and a feeling of empowerment. And we build, a foundation on which future generations can build. And that's, what I hope that at the minimum we are doing that.
Stephanie Luce, good talking to you. Right after this interview, I talked to Megan Heiss yesterday. We pre-recorded. She's one of the local organizers here. And people should stay tuned and listen to hear about how they can get involved in participate in the Troublemakers School. It's this Saturday at 9 a.m., and you'll hear all the details. Stephanie Luce, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. As promised, Bill now talks with Megan Heiss, a local organizer of the upcoming Portland Troublemakers Workshop.
Megan Heiss, welcome to the Old Mole on Cable Radio.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Megan's a great, dedicated, thoughtful, funny movement organizer here in Portland. She's one of the hosts of KBOO's Labor Radio and one of the organizers of Labor Notes Troublemakers School, coming to Portland this Saturday. Megan, what's a troublemaker?
What's a troublemaker? Well, Bill, I think we're taught in school, we're taught in the workplace to just keep our head down and do what we're told. And I think fundamentally a troublemaker is somebody who doesn't do that, who believes in justice and is not afraid to challenge the status quo and work for what's right.
And also for us troublemakers, a vision of a different society. Now with all the challenges facing the U.S., we really have to do things differently. The troublemaker has that larger vision.
Absolutely. And certainly in this context, we're talking about people doing largely union work.
Yeah, well, a strong labor movement sort of is crucial to any kind of great sort of social change or transformation.
I couldn't agree more.
And have to combine together with other movements. That's one of the themes of the Labor Notes of the Troublemakers Conference.
Absolutely. We're talking about new directions for labor, and we're talking about social movement unionism and how unions can be part of a movement, can be part of growing a true movement that is fighting for all workers.
There's lots of troublemakers in this country, actually, all over the country. They formed this network, basically, catalyzed by Labor Notes. Tell us about the Labor Notes School that's coming to Portland this Saturday.
Cool. Yeah, Bill. So the origins, I think, of this 2013 Troublemakers School in Portland is really the last Troublemakers Conference in 2012 in Chicago that was organized. There was a large contingent of Portland folks who went to that conference, came back really energized and wanted to do something to create a regional convergence like what they experienced in Chicago, about bringing people together to build skills and build solidarity in Portland.
And tell stories together of successful organizing there. And there is successful organizing in this country. And talking about not just labor organizing or labor union organizing, but the much larger necessity, right, of, in fact, alerting working class people, the whole population almost, to what's happening, and that it can be changed.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a great example and somebody I'm really excited about meeting is Sarah Chambers, who's part of the Caucus of Rank and File Educators of the Chicago Teachers Union, and she'll be coming next Saturday to Portland to talk about the Chicago Teachers Union's most recent strike and also their work to stop school closures in Chicago. And that is really, I think, one of the best examples we have of social movement unionism in this country. And it shows that the teachers in Chicago are gaining massive popular support by championing the issues that are important to working families in Chicago.
Yeah, they've really reached out to parents, and their sort of commitment and struggle has really captured tremendous support amongst parents in Chicago, which is why Rahm Emanuel and all the rest of the boy millionaires have had to back off.
Absolutely, and it's why they're also such a target, I think. And, you know, we're looking at the teachers locally in Portland, their contract's up June 30th. We have a lot of public employee contracts up that will expire this June 30th. And I think that especially for public sector unionists, this is going to be an important opportunity to see what we can learn from what's been done in Chicago, how we can apply that here, and how we can really win for all workers and beat back the budget cuts, beat back the school closures, and preserve our, you know, wages and benefits.
I take it that Mark Brenner, who's the editor of Labor Notes, he's also going to be speaking on building a new labor movement. What do you I mean, there's no one as knowledgeable as Mark, in fact, because they're covering every struggle in the United States. Maybe you can give us a little sense of what he's going to be dealing with.
I think and the subject that he will be talking about is twofold. First, he's going to he'll be speaking in a workshop. He'll be organizing a workshop called Beating Apathy, which is, I think, historically one of the most popular Labor Notes workshops. And in fact, we've seen that people in Portland are very interested in that one. That's the most popular workshop that people are signing up for. And I think it speaks to this issue of people struggle with how to connect with their coworkers, how to connect with their neighbors, and they want to learn how to be more effective. They want to be successful in educating and mobilizing. And so Mark will really draw on the experience in the room and coach people in how to move their coworkers and neighbors to get involved and take action, even starting with the most, you know, the smallest examples. Then he'll be speaking at lunch about new directions for labor. One of the stories I'm really curious to hear him speak to is the restaurant workers in New York, because he's based in Brooklyn, and I'm fascinated by the most recent walkout and how that kind of new unionism that's emerging to deal with the low-wage retail and fast food industry.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I'm looking forward to in Mark's talk is Labor Notes has been covering the environmental struggles and making common cause with lots of environmental organizations who themselves are recognizing they have to reach out to workers and ensure that everybody recognizes in the new economy, which is going to be necessary, that in fact we need good jobs for people, that people have to feel secure that they're going to be able to live decently and get an income to live decently. That's also part of his talk, I understand.
I believe so, yes. And I think it couldn't come at a more crucial time, especially in Portland, where we're really wrestling with these issues.
Let's close this interview, Megan. We'll see you this Saturday. But tell us where is the conference, what time? Airport Way is the location. Does Max go there, incidentally?
So Max goes nearby, and then you'll have to hop on the bus. But if you check out the website, if you go to labornotes.org and click on events, you'll find a link with everything you need to know about the local Troublemakers School. And again, it's this Saturday, April 13th. Registration begins at 9. We're going to 5 p.m. And I'd like to give a shout out to the Inner City Blues Festival that's happening also Saturday night. We're making that the after party. We want everybody to join us there. And the Troublemaker School will be held at the IBEW Local 48 Hall, specifically their training center on 16021 Northeast Airport Way. And registration is still open. You can join us. We're providing food, so you'll have breakfast, lunch, and a light snack afterwards during the reception. And scholarships are available. No one will be turned away for lack of funds, so definitely check it out.
Yeah, and you can find all that information at, if you just Google Portland Troublemakers School, and there's people to call up if you have any questions.
Absolutely.
Portland Troublemakers School this Saturday at 9 a.m. on Airport Way. Thanks a lot.
See you there.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. In the early 1970s, General Augusto Pinochet, with the help of the CIA, overthrew and murdered the democratically elected Chilean President Salvador Allende and established, with U.S. backing, a brutal right-wing dictatorship. A new film entitled No tells the story of his eventual ouster by the Chilean people. Here are Movie Mole's Fran Michel and Jan Hawken to discuss the film.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Jan Hawken to review No, the movie that was Chile's first nominee for the Foreign Language Oscar. Starring Gael Garcia Bernal and directed by Pablo Larraín, the film is currently playing in Portland at Cinema 21. The movie focuses on Chile's 1988 plebiscite on the rule of dictator General Augusto Pinochet. Pressured by the international community to legitimate the power he took in the bloody 1973 coup against democratically elected Salvador Allende, the government asked Chileans to vote yes to another 8 years of Pinochet, and the No campaign involved 17 opposition parties demanding democratic elections. The film centers on a fictional young advertising executive, Raul Saavedra, played by Bernal, who's brought in by the No campaign to help with their daily 15 minutes of allotted television time, while the leftist and other opposition politicians plan a campaign emphasizing the horrors of Pinochet's rule. Saavedra insists on an upbeat, humorous, and somewhat vacuous campaign, like those he's designed for sodas, soap operas, and microwave ovens. He's opposed by his advertising boss, Lucho Guzman, played by Alfredo Castro, who's working for the Yes campaign, and by his leftist ex-wife, Veronica, played by Antonio Zegers, who thinks the vote is pointless anyway, since it's likely to be stolen by the junta. The film uses archival footage, and the new material is shot on the same kind of equipment used originally, giving the movie a lot of bleeding colors and lens flares. So one thing that people have noted about this film is that it does not, of course, present history entirely accurately.
Well, that's, of course, a regular and predictable complaint that films never do encompass the history that matters to people. And so when you take up this kind of territory, this kind of historical material, there's always a question of what are your obligations to those events and to the actors in those events, the actual historical actors? Are there omissions that are reasonable, or are there distortions and deletions that we would contest? And here, some of the participants, the actual historical participants in the No campaign, have charged that the film really presents a caricature of that movement. And we might also suggest that the film carries its own devices too far, that it presents a caricature of the junta in its own campaigns to overthrow the military junta. But does the film enact that as well by creating too much of a kind of cartoon version of historical events?
Doesn't seem to me that the presentation of the junta is itself really misleading. They do give us a lot of information about the thousands of people killed and disappeared and exiled. We do get that information, and a number of the characters in the film object to the way that the positive campaign does not do justice to my brother was disappeared, my family was killed, and people have very deep objections to what might seem a trivializing of the suffering that the country has gone through and that so many people have gone through at that point. So I think we do get a good sense of that. What some of the No participants have objected to also is that we don't get a sense of the kind of grassroots activism and the enormous move to register voters and to encourage people to come out to vote on a one-to-one kind of grassroots basis that was really crucial to the campaign. We get the sense that, well, they had a snappy jingle and they had these cheerful people dancing in the commercials, and that's what made everybody come out and vote. But of course, we need to know that I think that it's very important that there be massive organizing and grassroots work, and people have to be registered to vote and understand how to vote in order to be able to do something like that. So it seems to me that's a more significant omission.
And I think along those lines, it seems to counterpose a kind of intellectualism that's associated with the left and a grassroots organizing set against the creativity and vibrancy of commercial culture, which has some basis to it, and perhaps we can return to that. But also omitted was the history of very innovative, creative organizing in Chile, the use of pots and pans in the streets at 8 p.m. every night to express protest against the regime, the use of singing in the streets, which apparently was banned by Pinochet at some point, the theater movement and arts movements there. So there was a tremendous flourishing of creativity within the left that you don't see. You see a kind of old school political presence, and you also see the left being presented as engaged in bloody conflict with the police, and which was part of the picture, but it once again leaves out the more organized resistance.
Yes, we certainly get a sense that the creative people in the country, the artists, were on the side of the No vote. There's one moment when Guzman, who's working with the Yes campaign, they're setting up their commercial or their 15 minutes of television one day, and they only have a handful of performers because we say, and he says sort of apologetically, well, it's the bottom of the barrel. All the artists are with the other side. So we do get, in that sense, we get a kind of nod to the fact that the artists were on the side of the No campaign, but we don't get a sense of those artists really giving their creative input. We see them as performers, they're singing, they're dancing, but they seem to be taking direction, as it were, from this small group of people who are directing the campaign.
I think it does raise the question, though, in an interesting way that's somewhat unusual in films, as you move into the story and see the conflict over strategy of how you do enlist the technologies and the knowledge that gets produced in a capitalist society and promoting commodity culture, how you use advertising and the media to promote revolutionary aims. Audre Lorde is famous for saying the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Well, it's not also clear which tools do belong to the master and which belong to the people. And there's a difference between this kind of vacuous happiness that was part of initially the No campaign, drawing on just an upbeat message. And over time, I think the film tried to draw out more satire, mocking the junta, also combining this message with inspirational testimonials. So it is, I think, an important question, how we do distinguish between the master's tools and the people's tools.
I think another thing that it is a reminder of is that, of course, people do need optimism and do need to have some sense of hope. Part of the reason the film acknowledges when they're planning the campaign, in one of their strategy sessions, they're talking about the fact that part of their problem is a lot of people are afraid to vote, and a lot of people think there's no point in voting. They don't acknowledge this in the film, although you can get more information from the film's official website that, in fact, there had been plebiscites previously, and in fact, Pinochet's government had rigged the voting so that he won. And so there's a sense of, well, why bother? And yet, I mean, the need to have something positive and some hope obviously is something that motivates people and is important to the success and the continuation of movement so that we don't simply collapse into despair. Clearly, in the case of the Obama campaign, the possibility of hope and change was something that motivated a lot of people. And it's clearly an important factor in the development of movements.
And that, I think, hope in the film was based on a struggle over how important the winning the plebiscite was, the vote. And it, in casting it starkly in terms of yes and no, it added to this idea that you could decisively win a victory that would change the course of history. And the film did come down on that side as a kind of liberal denouement. I mean, it was a very decisive victory at the end, although we could argue it did that. Did it kind of undercut that in a certain way? But it did present a kind of decisive victory over the military junta that history has suggested was more complicated and far less decisive than the film suggests.
Indeed, and I would argue that the film does question the degree of change represented by the outcome of the vote, because at the very end we see Saavedra again pitching a campaign to clients, and he's doing it in exactly the same terms. This is really speaking to the social context of the time, he says, as he introduces their sample reel of advertisements. So it seems to be a suggestion that we are going back to business as usual. And in fact, in a lot of ways, that's what happened in Chile. The constitution that was put in place during Pinochet's regime was validated by his successor. The denationalization that he engaged in, the privatizing of a lot of the public services, was kept in place. So the neoliberal economic model that Pinochet was, with the support and encouragement of the U.S., responsible for instituting in Chile is something that they're still grappling with. And the student movement of the last few years has been actively working against and trying to undo the legacy of that regime that has not gone away.
So it's definitely worth seeing, and has a lot of merits, and has certainly opened up an interesting set of debates in response to the film. So this is Jan Hocken and Fran Michel talking today about the film No, still playing at Cinema 21 in Portland.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. While the U.S. economy itself seems to be in a state of perpetual crisis, most economists agree the European Union is in a much deeper and immediate crisis. Now Joe Clement talks with Steve McGriffin, an associate professor of international relations at the American Graduate School in Paris, who is in town to discuss the European crisis at an upcoming event at the Red and Black Cafe.
Thanks, Tom. Well, I am joined here by Steve McGriffin. He is in Portland for the first time. I'm glad to have you on the Old Mole. Thanks for coming, Steve.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So you've come out to speak at an event tomorrow night at the Red and Black, which starts... Wednesday night at the Red and Black, which starts at 7. And you're here to talk about the European crisis. We all have heard about the riots and the scary organizing going on in Greece, and now it's coming to Cyprus, but I think that maybe a lot of listeners may not know a lot of the details. What do people need to know about what's been going on in Europe?
Well, first of all, why are people rioting? If you look at unemployment figures, they're quite devastating. In the 17 member states of the European Union that use the euro as their currency, the overall unemployment rate is 12%. In the EU, of 27 countries as a whole, it's slightly lower, 11%. That means that within the European Union, over 26 million people are unemployed. But this disguises huge differences. The unemployment rate in Germany is 5%. In Greece, it's 26%. In Spain, it's 26%. Amongst young people in those Mediterranean countries, though, the unemployment rate varies from like 40% in some to 60% in others. That's people under 26. If you're under 26 in Spain or Italy, and you're in work, you're part of a minority of young people. And, of course, what you get is a culture of poverty. You get a culture of self-help. Those are great things. But what you don't get is any prospect for a future life, any way of seeing your way through, you know, what you might call a normal human life pattern. You know, you're never going to have a job where you get paid more than the minimum wage if you're lucky. And that's writing off a whole generation is an extremely dangerous thing to do. And, you know, most young people don't lie at home and weep when they lose their jobs and when nobody takes any notice. They get out on the street and they riot because the cops attack them, basically.
A popular perception of Europe is that there are lots of state safeguards for unemployment, and some people might think that, oh, if unemployment's so high, it's not going to be as bad as in the United States because you have more state support. How has that been changing over the last, you know, several decades? We're remembering Margaret Thatcher today, and it really kind of takes us back to where a lot of this began.
Yeah, I was wondering if you'd mentioned Mrs. Thatcher. I'd probably better not comment on that. Well, Mrs. Thatcher occupied my part of England and did what the current government is doing as well. Yes, we have unemployment benefit. We have highly developed welfare states in the West. I mean, the basic rule is the further east you go, the less true that is. Well, why have we got those? Because we fought for them. The labor movement fought for them. The women's movement fought for them. And then, you know, three great nations, which had huge ideological differences, the Soviet Union, the United States, and the United Kingdom, got together and beat the biggest and best army the world's ever seen. So people came back from that terrible war, having defeated Nazism, and they wanted a better life. The kind of basic slogan in people's minds was never again. And the ruling class, the capitalist class, was willing and really forced into a position where it had to accommodate that. So they constructed a system in the Netherlands, which I know very well, they call it the Polder model, in which, for example, the bosses' organizations, the labor organizations, and the government sits around the table every fall and discusses labor rates, wage rates in different industries. And those wage rates used to be completely respected. This doesn't happen in the UK, but in the rest of Western Europe, Northwestern Europe, it did. Now, if you're a US company, for instance, and you can register your business in Latvia, you can hire a skilled worker on a building site which for your company which has got that job, and you can pay Latvian workers or Lithuanian workers or Polish workers, you can pay them the minimum wage in the Netherlands, not the minimum wage for that rate. So what you get is you get an Eastern European worker being paid less than, maybe $10 an hour, working alongside a Dutch worker that's got total health benefits and so on, which that other worker isn't going to get, and he's going to be getting $30 an hour. Well, that's a great, you know, the EU has this image, it won the Nobel Prize for Peace, for goodness sake, of encouraging international peace and harmony. Well, you know, that's a great way to do it. The Latvian guy's thinking, why is this guy getting three times my pay when we're doing just the same work? And the Dutch guy's thinking, I come in here stealing our jobs and working for a third. You know the situation, you have versions of it here in the United States. So it's disastrous. You know, the labor movement is trying to construct resistance to that. The point is that the European Union can claim no credit for those wonderful welfare states that we had, and they were wonderful. They're one of the greatest achievements of the human race, the welfare state. They can't claim any credit for it. On the contrary, their policies, their extreme version of neoliberal market capitalism, which they're imposing on 27 countries, or really what it is the big countries imposing it on everybody else, that is actually destroying these systems. And also it's undermining democracy. The French and Dutch people, actually voted against the current constitution, if you like, of the European Union, the Lisbon Treaty, and they're ignored. They weren't even allowed to vote again when they voted no. You know, it was a done deal. They were going to get it, whatever we said.
Nowadays, there are two ways of describing the region that a lot of us grew up in geography classes learning to call just Europe. There is the EU on the one hand, and there is the Eurozone on the other. And how does this figure into what you're describing and what a lot of people are describing as basically a market coup of otherwise elected governments?
Well, the latest move is to set up a system which will apply to all 27 member states, but will apply in a more intense form to the 17 that use the euro. They're going to call it European Economic Governance. Well, they are calling it that. And what it means is your democratically elected government, well, even if you think they're democratically elected for your sins in a previous life, as in the UK, your democratically elected government, good or bad, has come up with a national budget for the next 12 months. Okay, they've always had to present that to their parliament so the people can have their say through their representatives. Now, they'll have to do that eventually, but the immediate thing they have to do is present it to the European Commission, which is an unelected executive, and the unelected commission can not only say, hey, we don't like this budget, you're spending too much, or you're spending too little on this, too much on that, your taxes are too high. They can even interfere in your incomes policy. They can say your wages in this sector are too high. I suppose in theory they can say they're too low, but, you know, that's not going to happen. So they talk about economic imbalances. So really you've got a semi-dictatorship. You know, you've got your democratically elected government and parliament coming up with a budget, you know, which is the most important thing, really. It's like, what are we going to spend where? And they have to send it to Brussels, and Brussels can send it back. You know, I mean, I'm a professor. I would send it back with a C- on it, perhaps, and they've got to go off and do it again, you know. So these undemocratic structures at European level are undermining the power of democratic structures, which, again, why have we got those democracies? Because working people and women and out-groups fought for them, you know.
In the last minute or two that we have, I'd like to turn to look to what we can look forward to in coming out to your event at the Red and Black on Wednesday.
Well, I'm going to be talking more in more detail, obviously, about what I've already talked about. I'm also going to talk about the way in which I think that, you know, you read a very good but essentially liberal economist, Paul Krugman, and he's puzzled. Why are they imposing these austerity policies? They don't work. Everybody's being thrown out of work. My argument is it's all actually deliberate, that they have had a number of ambitions, which you can trace back to, say, the Maastricht Treaty in the early 1990s. And their ambition is basically to transform Europe into a far more liberalized, deregulated economy. It's to cut wages. It's to cut what we call the social wage. That's, you know, the whole of welfare state, healthcare, etc. Cut all those things so that they can enhance the rate of profit. So actually, I see the whole thing from their point of view. It's highly successful, and the only way that we can undermine that is basically to do so in our workplaces, to get out on the street, to say this far and no further, to try to build a resistance movement across national differences. It's not always easy. We've got 23 official languages in the European Union. It's a crazy house in the Parliament because of that. But, you know, we have to try to get around that. We have, like, English, French, German, and there's a lot of people can speak one or the other. So we have to use these international languages. But we have to organize to stop this. It isn't a question of persuading them to change their policies. They have a clear goal. And the only way that we can turn them from that goal is by struggle, is by fighting back in various ways, using our industrial muscle, using what's left of our political parties, political power. Young people's initiatives in versions of the Occupy movement are also useful. I think we have to work together in different ways. You know, I think, you know, I'm nearly 60, my street fighting days are done, but I think I can make a contribution in one kind or another, and whatever we can contribute. Because people are suffering, you know, and if you look at who's suffering, the recent British government spending cuts, 85% of those cuts are going to be paid for by women, in effect. So there's a gender issue, there's a class issue, obviously there's ethnic groups that are more victimized than others, but it's a class war, but they declared it.
Well, that is all the time we have for now. If you want to hear more from Dr. Steve McGriffin, I urge you to come to the Red and Black Cafe. It's on the corner of Southeast 12th and Oak this Wednesday at 7. There's going to be a lecture about these topics, but then also further discussion where we can start to relate these issues on the other side of the pond to what's going on in the United States. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement.
Thank you, Joe and Steve. I'll be looking forward to that event myself. Once again, this is the Old Mole on KBOO. Concluding our program today, Laurie Bolden discusses an earlier work by the 2011 Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Visit from the Goon Squad. The book is Look at Me by Jennifer Egan.
Morning. To what extent is image tied to identity? Would others see me as the same person were my image to change markedly? Would I? These are a few of the questions Jennifer Egan asks in her complex and ambitious novel, Look at Me. Chances are, if you've heard of Egan, it's because of her 2011 Pulitzer-winning novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad. Today I want to talk about her earlier 2002 novel, Look at Me, which I see as even richer and more philosophically interesting than her prize winner, though both are superb. There are so many characters in this novel, each narrator of his or her story, that it's almost difficult to pick a lead character. And yet, certainly, it is the model, Charlotte Swenson, who is the pivot point. The reader meets Charlotte shortly after she's been involved in a horrific auto accident, one in which she's pulled away from the burning wreck by a Good Samaritan, and then quite literally put back together. Her broken arm, leg, and ribs, almost incidental to the reconstructive work on her face, whose crushed bones are reassembled with 80 titanium screws, and then another surgery a year later to fine-tune her broken face. For reasons the reader will learn as she reads the book, the accident occurs close to Charlotte's hometown of Rockford, Illinois, where much of the subsequent action occurs, although Charlotte herself returns as quickly as she can to her New York apartment and hopefully to her life as a model. Apparently, the reconstructive surgery is remarkably successful in that she's still a beautiful woman. But as soon as she discovers that she is literally unrecognizable to the circle of models and agents whom she has lived among for well over a decade, quote, I'd postponed reckoning with the world for the simple reason that I still didn't know what I looked like. I'd spent as long as an hour staring through the ring of chalky light around my bathroom mirror. I'd held up old pictures of myself beside my reflection and tried to compare them. But my sole discovery was that in addition to not knowing what I looked like now, I had never known. The old pictures were no help. Like all good pictures, they hid the truth. I had never kept a bad one. This was one of my cardinal rules, photographically speaking. One, never let someone take your picture until you're ready, or the result will almost certainly be awful. Two, never keep bad pictures of yourself for any reason, sentimental or otherwise. Bad pictures reveal you in exactly the light you wish never to be seen. Not only will they be found if you keep them, but invariably by the single person in the world you least want to see you that way. Close quote. The question of identity, of how we see ourselves and how we are seen by others, is crucial in this tale, not only for Charlotte the model, where image is everything, but for all of the main characters as well. Moose, the older brother of Charlotte's childhood friend Ellen, metamorphoses from an easygoing, dashing, and sought-after athlete in high school into a morose and enigmatic professor understood by none and shunned by most because of his startling and unpredictable behavior. He wanders his hometown of Rockford, seeing the future by studying the past of this one-time industrial hub reduced now to a kind of ghost of its former self. Muttering the phrase over and over, "We are what we see," and fascinated by the invention of clear glass in the 1300s, he searches for someone to whom he can pass on his insight, his foresight, his scorching epiphanies. Quote, for Moose had sensed that a terrible reversal was in progress, a technological disaster whereby the genius of the Industrial Revolution would be turned on people themselves, whereby human beings would be assembled from parts just as guns and boots and bicycles had been once. Close quote. Moose thinks perhaps his niece Charlotte, almost certainly named after his sister's childhood friend, is a candidate for carrying on his nearly unbearable prophecies. But it turns out that the 16-year-old Charlotte is attempting to find her own identity by starting up a sexual relationship with a much older man who is himself a shadowy figure whose identity is less certain, more plastic, than either of the Charlottes, or for that matter, than anyone else he encounters. Add to this list of identity casualties an alcoholic private detective cut loose from his past by events he refuses to disclose, and the cast of characters is almost complete. Egan mixes in one more, a reporter who wants to interview Charlotte not because of an interest in fashion, but as an instance of a person whose appearance has changed drastically. Quote, I'm interested in the relationship between interior and exterior, how the world's perception of women affect our perceptions of ourselves. A model whose appearance has changed drastically is a perfect vehicle, I think, for examining the relationship among image, perception, and identity, because a model's position as a purely physical object, a media object, if you will, is in a sense just a more exaggerated version of everyone's position in a visually based, media-driven culture, and so watching a model renegotiate a drastic change in her image could prove a perfect lens. Close quote. What is personal identity? What is the truth about the past, about the future, about ourselves, and who is to discover and untangle it? There is so much in this book that I cannot in a short space even begin to lay out the issues, the mysteries, the questions. And to add a final element to the tangle, there is a character named Z, who is adept in languages, changes identities as easily as changing a coat, and who remains always in the shadows. He has come to this country from somewhere, no one knows quite where, searching for the conspirators and for the plan of subjugation that allow America to rule the world. Finally, in America, quote, standing in their midst, he felt the peculiar dizzying pleasure of hating a thing so purely you'll do anything to destroy it, anything, a pleasure that was indistinguishable from the wish to be destroyed himself, consumed, close quote. A mystery, a tragedy, and in some remarkable ways a comedy as well. This is an excellent novel written in language that is as sharp-edged and contemporary as the world she describes. It's a fine example of my favorite sort of fiction, stories about us, here, now. I've been talking about Jennifer Egan's Look at Me. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Musical interludes have been by blues guitarist Matthew Stubbs, currently the lead guitarist in Charlie Musselwhite's blues band. Remember the two upcoming events. April 10th on the European Crisis at the Red and Black Cafe, and the Portland Troublemakers Workshop on April 13. Google for details. Those details will also be on our webpage tomorrow, and you can check out the OMO webpage. This program will be podcast, as I just said, on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/OMO Variety Hour. And this is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Stay tuned now for Air Cascadia with locally produced news, interviews, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andrea. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Eric Dinerstein, author of The Kingdom of Rarities, which takes us to some of the least traveled places on the planet to catch a glimpse of the rarest animals in the world. We'll talk about the ecological importance of these species and the urgency of protecting all forms of life in our ecosphere. At 11, we'll hear Health Watch, hosted by Dr. David Naiman. Today's guest is gynecologist Dr. Sarah Gottfried, author of the book The Hormone Cure, which tells how women exactly what they can do to optimize their hormone systems without drugs or invasive therapies. At 11:30, it's Madness Radio with host Will Hall, news and views from outside the realm of mental health.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, April 8th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. This morning, we are fortunate to have Portland's own Mark Lakeman joining us to launch the 2013 Village Building Convergence. Hunter-gatherers in the White House, in Beijing, in Bonn. You never know. It might be the only thing that'll save Europe and the U.S. for that matter. First, this from the National Weather Service. Scattered showers today, the overcast skies, highs around 58, light wind, and for tonight, pretty much the same with a low around 41, and for tomorrow, partly sunny skies with a high around 62. Tomorrow night, could get a few showers late, otherwise a low around 51, not much in the way of wind. And starting out the week with the alternative forecast, we have a waning crescent flower moon in Aquarius, 27 days old. The synodic forecast has this. They say it's not a good time to be doing much of anything in the garden, but other than weeding and composting. Though if you were a winter gardener, there's a lot out there to harvest. And this is an absolutely excellent time of year for getting out there and foraging. More on that later when we speak with Mark Lakeman. The biodynamic forecast with the moon in Aquarius, it's an air sign, it's a good time to sow flowering plants. And a great many other things too. Biodynamicists have a different outlook, and a lot of what they do tends to pan out and very successfully, as long as you're careful and follow directions. The sidereal forecast of the moon in Pisces. This is the best sign for planting soft fruit. It's a time of maximum water intake for plants. So if you're thinking of some bare root fruit trees, and why not think about bare root fruit trees, now's a good time to be planting those. Get those in the ground now when there's plenty of water. But be careful about that, because it's heavy, wet, soggy ground is not good for a lot of things. And that's it for the forecast, both conventional and alternative. We're going to speak now with Mark Lakeman with the Village Building Convergence for 2013, and this year we've got the theme is urban succession, shift and sprout. That's very interesting. Succession is a very, very important factor to be considered, especially in permaculture, but in many other approaches to growing things. I want to welcome Mark to the KBOO Airways, and we're so glad to have you with us this morning.
Thanks, Chris. How are you doing?
We're doing really well here. It's fine. We know. I want to first, before we do anything else, thank everyone who participated in the recent membership drive. Everyone who became a member, renewing members, all of the volunteers, all of the programmers, all the people who made that happen and continue to make it happen 365 days a year. We are very, very grateful to everyone who supports this station. It is sort of like growing your own food in a way.